Episode 782, My Strength is My Story with Julianne Burleson, Surviving Camp Inca.
Moms, needing a little inspiration and a ray of hope? You've come to the right place. This is the show that you can turn to for just the pick-me-up you need. This is Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Here's your host, certified life coach, personal trainer, and nutritionist, Christiane Wargo. Staring at a stop
sign, watching people drive. Happy, happy day. I am so excited. Today is My Strength is My Story, and we have a courageous, brave woman with us. You are going to be mesmerized by her story. And I want you to keep in mind, this happened in 1995 to 2000. This is recent. This is real. It's not fiction. But before we go into any of that, I want to give a warm hug and a huge shout out to all of our brand new family members. To anybody who knows Julianne and is listening because you want to hear her sweet story as she tells it, welcome to the family. I'm delighted of your presence. If you already haven't had the opportunity, you'll want to head on over to createyournow.com where you can learn more and sign up for the Kisses newsletter, the Keep It Simple Strategy Everyday Solutions to Live, Love, and Impact. And I'm telling you, you will be impacted today. Julianne shares an incredible journey that she took. She talks about that she's lived three lives. She lived her life before Camp Inca. She lived her life in Camp Inca, and then she lives her life now. You've got to sit back. You've got to grab your favorite cup of Joe, whether it's tea or coffee or hot cocoa, or maybe it's just your bottle of water. Sit back, and I want you to soak it in, because you know what? God's got something special for you. He wants you to hear something today. She's going to share something with you, and I promise you, open up your mind, open up your heart, connect the two. God's going to be there, and you're going to hear something special today. Without further ado, let's welcome in Julianne Burleson, Surviving Camp Inca. Welcome to Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. Today is My Strength is My Story Day, and we have an absolutely extraordinary woman within our presence today. Oh my goodness. This is a God-sent, heavenly gift woman that is going to not only rock your world, but she is going to show you a vivid illustration of the resilience within her own human spirit. You see, that this is something that God gifted her, and this person I'm referring to is Julianne Burleson. She is a profound and captivating inspirational speaker, number one best-selling author on Amazon, and a healing artist in the modality of reflexology by trade. She is a friend, a sister in Christ, and Julianne, welcome to Create Your Now.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing so well. It is such an honor to have you here. Thank you for taking the time to have an extraordinary, probably a longer coffee chat.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, today we're going to be talking about your haunting true story. And when I read your book, Surviving Camp Inca, A Life-Changing Prison Experience, I got to tell you, this rocked my day and night. And every single page turn, I was either gagging, I was laughing, I was crying, I was mad. I felt every emotion, and I cannot imagine what you went through. So first off, I just have to say thank you for being so vulnerable and writing your story. I know you all will want to pick up a copy of her book. Be sure to check in our show notes, and it will have all the links that you need there. So Julianne, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, at the moment, I live in Knoxville, Tennessee, and actually, after the Ecuador experience, I moved here because my father lived here, and I've been here ever since. I love Knoxville. It's beautiful. We're about 45 minutes from Gatlinburg, and it's just beautiful to get away to the mountains whenever we, you know, need a break. And I have a wonderful husband. His name is Gary, and he really is my sweetheart. I mean, and my biggest encourager. He's definitely encouraged me to tell my story and to kind of come out of my shell.
Well, and actually, that's how I knew of you, is because I met your husband at a conference. Very interesting. In reading your book, that's kind of how you two met. And we don't want to go into that story quite yet. We'll get to that part. But how long have you two been married?
We've been married going on 14 years. Wow. And we're still in love. We're our marriage is great. Aww. We've had a great time being married.
Yes. Well, you definitely more than deserve a happy life, truly. And I want us to give a backdrop to the listeners, because your story is profound. It is earth-shattering. And when I was reading it, I had to go back during the time that it occurred. And I was like, well, where was I when all of this? Why didn't I hear something about this? And so for some of the listeners, they're going to be thinking, I didn't know this kind of stuff happened. So you want to stay tuned, because it is going to get juicy. It's going to be raw. And I know Julianne is going to bring her heart to this. So take us back to when you were growing up, because you weren't raised in Tennessee, but you started in California.
Yeah, I was raised pretty much in Orange County. I pretty much grew up in Costa Mesa, Newport Beach area. I was a beach girl. I loved anything to do with the beach. My first job actually was renting boogie boards at 12 years old on the beach, so to tourists. So, you know, anytime you look for me, that's where you found me, pretty much. But, yeah, and then in my 20s, I actually moved to West Hollywood. Ooh. And, or actually Studio City area. I had a boyfriend that I had met out there, and we lived together for a while in Studio City, and then we broke up and I moved to West Hollywood. And since I was about 16, I mean, I started going to the Hollywood nightclubs and going to concerts, and I met all kinds of bands. Going to see bands was kind of my thing. Mm-hmm. And so I met U2 at a very young age, and Gwen Stefani, and Duran Duran. I mean, on my 18th birthday, actually, Duran Duran sang Happy Birthday to me on stage.
Oh, my goodness.
At the Forum. Yeah. So I just love going to nightclubs. I wasn't really too much of a partier as far as drugs and alcohol, but mm-hmm. I just love to be around music. I love to dance. I love to hang out and meet interesting people. And I mean, my dad used to call me a world traveler before I ever traveled anywhere. I mean, because my favorite book was like the Atlas. So I always thought if I met interesting people that, you know, were from all over the world, that I would have more of an opportunity to travel.
Mm-hmm. And definitely in California, you meet a lot of interesting people, especially in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, gosh, I lived in an apartment building in West Hollywood where many of my neighbors actually were in the entertainment business. I had a friend that her father was in Aerosmith. I mean, we were across the street from the House of Blues. And so we went there all the time to see, like, people, you know, bands and people, and we always had a great time. We were a couple doors down from the Comedy Store. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time there was an earthquake, the owner of the Comedy Store would actually put us up to feed us and give us, you know, somewhere to stay if we needed it. I mean, so it was really a lifestyle. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just a community that was always a lot of fun, and nobody ever really took anybody too seriously. And I mean, I look back and I think about those days, and, you know, I reminisce. I mean, I just saw that movie La La Land, and I thought, oh my gosh, that took me back to that time in my life completely.
Yes.
That feeling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially with the House of Blues.
Oh, yeah. The House of Blues was wonderful. I mean, I used to go there all the time. I mean, and I remember one night, it was a Sunday night, and my friend said, oh, let's go. They're having a jam night. We don't know who's playing. Stevie Wonder was playing. And there was maybe 10 people in the audience, because nobody knew. It was a surprise. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, my gosh, what a blessing that I can walk right across the street and see Stevie Wonder play.
Man, a lifestyle. Oh, my goodness. And freedom. I mean, you just sound like you were just living it up.
Yeah, we used to just walk everywhere. We used to walk down to the House of Blues, to the Viper Room, to the Rainbow Room. I mean, you name it. It's like anything along the Sunset Strip, it was within walking distance from my house. So, I mean, you didn't even need a car.
And great weather. You know, it does help when you're in California to have that beautiful weather.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful weather and great cafes and lots of shopping. And, oh, life was good. It really was.
Yes, life was good. And then speak to us a little bit about, because this good friend that you had, you also went to church with her.
No, actually, she was best friends with my next door neighbor. And so she used to hang out at our pool all the time. And I was in the catering business at the time. So I would usually work in the morning. I go to work real early around 6 and get home around 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And then just go lay by my pool, have a glass of wine and relax, you know. And so we kind of became friends. And after a while, she was like, hey, let's go get our nails done. Let's, you know, go have dinner. Let's go have a movie. And I was like, okay, let's go. And I realized with time, it's like this girl didn't really work. She didn't seem to, but she always had everything that she needed. And I soon figured out that she had a rich boyfriend. So so that's pretty common actually in California. And so I didn't think much of it. And we just kind of, you know, we our friendship evolved pretty much.
How did you end up following, because there your parents were separated at a younger age?
Yeah, they were. They separated when I was a teenager, around 12 or 13, and my father actually went to live in Tennessee, and my mom stayed with me in California. And that was around the time we lived in Costa Mesa, Newport Beach, and it was hard. It was really hard, because I was a daddy's girl. You know, and I did go to visit him in Tennessee a few times in my teenage years, and I couldn't wait to get back to California, because I was like, I was always on American Bandstand as a teenager, so I was kind of going back and forth a lot, and music was really my thing. I mean, I just, I always thought maybe I would, you know, be in the entertainment business somehow, like maybe being a talent scout. I have a really good ear and eye for like talent. And, but no, I never did follow those dreams.
No, you had a few hiccups, I think, along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, just a scenic few. Route.
Yeah. A long scenic route. Yes. One that I don't think most people would want to go. And so your experience, because I think it's important with what you're going to talk about with regarding surviving Camp Inca, is where were you with your relationship as a Christian, or how did that set with you in those years?
Well, when I was, I had accepted the Lord back when I was 12. I went to a church called Calvary Chapel. It's in Costa Mesa. And I was actually baptized down in Corona del Mar in the ocean. And, you know, at that time I wasn't talking with my dad a lot, and so I really felt lost. I was looking for an extended family. My mom was working full time as a single parent, so she didn't have a lot of time to spend with me as well. So I was home alone. I was like a latchkey kid, and sometimes we lived across the street from our church, so I'd go and speak to our pastor. He'd be like, "Hey, if you ever need someone to talk to." He was like the grandpa type, you know. And so we'd sit in the soccer field and talk for a couple hours, and he was just always such a blessing. Pastor Chuck Smith, he was just wonderful. And so you know, I felt like I needed a void filled. So then I accepted the Lord, I remember, at a camp up in Twin Peaks, up in Arrowhead. And oh my gosh, what a blessing. It's like I just felt like I didn't really need my biological father so much when the Lord was just filling that space in my heart. And, you know, and then I did move to Tennessee when I was 16 for a year just to finish out high school. And I thought, oh my gosh, now I can tell my dad about the Lord, and he'll know, you know, he'll accept the Lord. And but that didn't happen. Actually, it was really hard going to church, and my dad didn't really want any part of that lifestyle. And, you know, he was a single guy and pretty cool and stuff, so he would go out to bars and, you know, meet different people. And I kind of started down that lifestyle, too, because sometimes he would take me to those places. And, I mean, we had a great time. He'd take me out dancing, and, you know, so it was more like we were best friends, and I felt – but I did start to fall – far away from the Lord at that time. And then when I graduated high school, I decided to go back to California because it really was home and at the time. And so I went home and tried to get back connected with church and Bible studies and stuff, but it never did happen. I started meeting all the wrong people. Well, I shouldn't say all the wrong people, just people that weren't living that kind of a lifestyle.
It wasn't their focus.
Yeah, no, yeah. That wasn't their focus.
You moved out on your own, got this Hollywood flair. And then what happened then next is it took you on a trip.
Yeah, well, I just started working a lot of different retail jobs, and then I moved into doing a catering job, and the catering job actually was usually around a lot of entertainment people because it was commercial catering, so sometimes they would be filming something and we'd go and cater it. So, you know, it put me more in that lifestyle. But what led me to the Ecuador trip actually was this girl that I had, that we were talking about a little while ago, and that I used to hang out at the pool with.
And that was your neighbor.
Yeah. Right. Well, she was my neighbor's best friend.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. They used to just use our pool. Right. So one day she was like, because I was asking her about her boyfriend because she never, like, cheated on him. She would talk about her boyfriend all the time and stuff. And I would say, well, when am I going to meet this boyfriend? She's like, well, actually, she's like, we're going to Miami for the 4th of July. She's like, do you want to come with us? She goes, it'll be about a 4 or 5 day trip and it'll be really fun. There'll be about bunch of people there that we're meeting, so it won't just be like me and him. You won't feel like a third wheel. And I'm like, oh yeah, it sounds fun. So we planned that trip, and I think it was like 2 weeks until the trip came up. So I had told my family I was going and everything, and I hadn't been to Miami in a long time since I had been a teenager with my parents and stuff. So I was like, okay, yeah, let's go. So the trip finally came. We flew out there together, and we got there, and I met her boyfriend. And he was really sweet. I mean, nice guy. He was in the military and he was like, you know, just normal guy. And I guess he came from, supposedly came from a family that was kind of wealthy, even though he was in the military. So that's how he was able to spoil her. And he was actually getting ready to open up a restaurant in New York City. And anyway, so 4th of July night came and we're at a restaurant on Miami Beach on, and one night they just both asked me, they were like, hey, do you want to come to Ecuador with us? And I said, wait, you didn't say anything about Ecuador. I thought we were going to fly back to California. And she goes, oh yeah, you were, but I was going to go on to Ecuador with my boyfriend. And I was like, oh, I'm like, she goes, well, would you like to come with us? And I'm like, well, I don't know if I can afford it. You know, I came up with all these excuses why I couldn't go because I had cats, no one to look after them, and I couldn't afford the ticket and, you know, all the excuses. And they had an answer for everything. They're like, oh, don't worry about it. We'll pay for it and you can pay us back. You know, we'll call somebody, look after your cats. I mean, they had to answer for everything. And so by the end of the night, after having, you know, bottles of wine and watching the fireworks and just having so much fun, they were, you know, of course I said yes. And so we were excited. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I happen to have my passport with me too, because back then it was kind of cool to, when someone carded you, to have your passport. Anyways, so I always traveled with my passport no matter where I went. And so the next day, the night was great. And then the next morning I woke up and I could hear actually the my friend and her boyfriend fighting in the next room. And so I kind of poked my head out and I said, what's going on? And I said, well, I can't find my passport, you know, anywhere, it's lost. And he stormed out of the room and he left. And she's like, help me find it. So we tore the place apart looking for it and everything. And we couldn't find it anywhere. So a little while later, he came back and he's like, okay, this is the deal. I've changed our tickets, and I was like, oh, he's already bought – I guess he had bought the tickets the night before for me. And so he said, okay, this is the deal. I've changed the tickets. He said, we're going to go to the state – or the federal building, get a new, you know, passport for her, and you're going to be on the flight – today, and then we're going to meet you there tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I said, well, I don't really want to fly by myself. And they're like, oh, no, it's not a very long flight. You know, you'll be fine. We'll meet you the next day. And he also said that they had friends in Ecuador mm-hmm. and that they would meet me at the hotel and show me around until they got there. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, well, you know, so I thought about it and kind of went back and forth about it. And finally, I decided to go. So I flew into Ecuador, and I had an okay flight. It's just when I got there, it was really bizarre because I remember taxiing on the runway, and I could see people hanging on the fences, like at the airport, almost like refugees. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, where am I? Because I didn't really know anything about Ecuador. Mm-hmm. And actually, I thought I was flying to a beach because he was like, oh, yeah, you guys can hang out in the sun. And so I just automatically assumed we were going to a beach. I didn't realize we were going to somewhere like in the mountains.
Yes.
And we were like 12,000 feet in the Andes Mountains. So that was kind of a shock to me. But once I got there, I got a taxi, which wasn't the easiest thing to do. And I didn't speak the language, Spanish. Mm-hmm. And so I got a taxi to the hotel. And I remember when we pulled up to the hotel, I opened my door and put my foot out, and there were rats in the gutter.
Ugh.
And that freaked me out. I was like, oh, my gosh. Yeah, I don't even know that I'd even seen a rat up until this point in my life. Yeah, so it was really horrifying. And so I went into the hotel. The hotel was nice and everything. And anyways, so the next day, my friends called me on the phone and they said, we have bad news. And I said, oh no, what? And they said, well, we're not going to be able to make it. They're not giving out emergency passports right now because of the Unabomber. At that time, the Unabomber was making lots of threats to the federal buildings and all that. So anyways, they weren't giving them out at the time. And I said, okay, well, I'll be on the next flight home. I mean, no problems, whatever. And I said, oh, no, actually, if you can do us a huge favor and stay a few days and bring back some artwork for us. And I said, well, artwork? I said, you never said anything about artwork. And he said, well, that restaurant we were telling you about that we're going to open in New York, we were going to put this artwork in the restaurant. And I was like, oh. And he goes, that's what I was going down there for business. And I said, oh, okay. Well, that all makes sense now. And so anyways, we kind of went back and forth about that because I wasn't wanting to do that. I didn't understand why they couldn't just send it UPS or Federal Express or mail it or whatever. And he said, well, you're already there. It's only going to cost a few $100 to put it on the airplane and bring it with you. I said, so if you could just do this for us, it would be great. And I was like, I don't know, this little sixth sense was kind of nudging me, you know, not to do it, just to come home. But they said, Julian, you're a friend. We would never put you in a bad situation. They're like, please do this for us. And those words have definitely stuck with me. Anytime anyone's like, oh, come on, you know, I'm like, I'm always really leery now when anyone says anything like that. So anyways, the good friend that I was, I went ahead and said yes. Mm-hmm. So I spent the next 4 days. I was in Ecuador, actually 5 days, Quito. I spent the next 4 days touring around Quito, and it was beautiful. I mean, their friends kind of took me on this tour all around Quito. We went and visited all these old churches and all these historic sites, and it was great. Uh-huh. Their friends were kind of creepy in my book, but they weren't like the type of people I would normally hang out with. But I mean, they were nice, I mean, for the most part. Mm-hmm. One of them actually kept trying to come on to me a little bit, but he's kind of a little guy. And so I was like, okay, I got to handle it, you know, at the time.
That's right. You had experience in a Hollywood thing as to how to push people away when they got too close.
Oh, yes. So I thought I could handle this. So anyways, after 5 days of touring and stuff, and actually they had taken me to a little shop in Quito, and they had showed me the artwork that I was going to be bringing back on the plane. And so I had seen the artwork a few days before I left, and then the day that I was leaving to go to the airport, they brought it to my hotel. And I said, well, I want to unwrap it and see it. And they said, well, you saw it at the store. And I said, well, I know I did, but I want to make sure this is what I saw at the store, you know, that it's not something else. And so I did. I unwrapped a couple of the boxes and saw it, and it was the same artwork. So I put it all back, and then they went down to the taxi and, you know, were waiting for me. And I went to the bathroom to kind of straighten out myself, you know, make sure I had all my stuff.
Yep.
And when I looked in the mirror, it was the weirdest thing. I looked in the mirror and I saw myself. I was really gaunt and kind of pale and just real skinny. And I didn't look like myself. And then I kind of, you know, just closed my eyes and shook it off and looked back in the mirror, and I was back to myself. It was just the weirdest vision. And then my phone rang. And, well, I did hear, like, a little voice say, don't do this. Don't go. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I thought someone was in my room. And then the phone rang and scared me. And I jumped, and I answered it. And I said, yeah, and we're waiting for you in the taxi. And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll be right down. So I got my stuff together, went downstairs. Then we went to the airport, me and the two guys and the artwork. And the guys checked my artwork in for me at the airport, and then they left. And I decided I was going to go and exchange my money because I had some sucras that I needed to change back into dollars. So when I started to go to that to change my money, the next thing I know, I hear my name over the loudspeaker. And then in about a second, there was a guy or a lady right next to me. And she was like, you have to come with me. So they led me over to customs, which was actually like a big airplane hangar. And it was outside. It was very old, kind of was kind of World War II-ish. And we went outside and into this airplane hangar. And the three boxes of artwork were sitting there surrounded by dogs and like federale type officers, all in military garb. And so they led me over to them and they opened them and they said, we need to put them through the scanners. And they had a big scanner thing right next to it. And so I said, okay, yeah, that's fine. So they did. They took them out individually, and there were three boxes, and altogether there were 24 pictures.
Wow.
Yeah, they were about this big. They were oval shaped, and they were a scene of a countryside. And they were kind of made out of plaster. They were probably about like this thick and kind of tacky looking, something you'd see in like a Mexican restaurant. And they had little plastic figurines, like kind of like glued to them.
Oh, almost a 3D effect?
Yeah, kind of a 3D effect. Yeah. And they were all a little different. No two were the like, but they were just kind of tacky looking. So anyway, they took them out and they took out about five of them and they put them through the scanners and they kept putting them through. They put them through about three times and they didn't find anything. So then they brought the dogs over and the dogs were like sniffing them and, you know, they didn't seem like they really wanted anything to do with them. And then the next thing, I was kind of like, well, my plane is going to leave soon. is this going to take long? And they were like, oh, no, we do this like for everybody, big shipments. I'm like, okay. And they're broken English. And so I said, okay. So then they started holding it up to the light, knocking on them and shaking them and doing just random tests. And then they started putting them back in the box. And so I figured, okay, well, this is it. You know, we're done. And the next thing I knew, this guy comes out of nowhere and he looked very official. He had like the hat and the stripes and just very official looking guy. And he comes over and he takes one of the pieces of art and he leaves and he goes way over to an office in the far, you know, end of this airplane hangar. And the next thing I know, he comes back. He had taken a sharp object and drilled a tiny hole into the side of the piece of the art, and there was drugs flowing out of the artwork. So he comes running back and he's like, cocaine, cocaine, droga, droga. And I'm like, what? You know, I'm just freaking out. And the next thing I know, the police officers are ripping open all the other pieces of art and there is cocaine all over the floor in 24 pieces of art.
Oh,
and
gosh.
So I said, it's in all of them. And I just passed out cold.
Oh.
So the next thing I remember is I woke up in the back of the truck with my head between my knees and a big duffel bag over the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really see anything. I could see some boots, like military boots.
Mm-hmm.
There was about four guys in this truck. It was like a double cab truck.
Mm-hmm.
And there were four guys in the truck. I could hear dogs barking in the back of the truck with cages rattling. We were on very rough terrain. So I was just very I didn't know where I was. And so I tried to get up, and they kept pushing my head down and saying something. I don't know. I didn't understand them. And then I passed out again. And I have a theory, because I kept passing out after this, and mm-hmm. I have a theory that maybe they put chloroform over my face or something after the first time I passed out.
Yes.
I'm not sure, because I was groggy, like, for the next day.
Mm.
And so I finally woke up after two or three times of passing out, and when I woke up that time, I was still in the back of the truck, and I was on this hillside overlooking all of Quito, and there was nothing around, just the truck. I noticed that the dogs were gone, the artwork was, everything was off the truck. And so I looked around, I thought, oh my gosh, they've stolen all the artwork and they're going to blow up the truck. I mean, I just, my imagination went crazy. You can only imagine.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I got to run. And so I did. I opened the door and I started to run. Next thing I knew, this guy popped out of nowhere and he had a mini machine gun in his hand. And he starts pointing it at me and yelling at me in Spanish to get back in the truck. And anyways, he kind of cornered me, so I had to get back in the truck. So I did. And then I was kicking him the whole time and then he slammed the door. And then I passed out again. So I found out I either passed out under stress or I was drugged or something. So,
yeah. Or maybe a combination thereof.
Yeah, probably nerves or whatever. And so then I wake up another time. The last time I wake up is I'm at a compound, and it turned out that was the Interpol compound for international police. And they had left me in the truck again. And when I woke up, there was a little dictionary sitting next to me, English-Spanish dictionary. And so I grabbed it, started looking up the word set up and some other phrases. And so I got out of the truck and I started walking to these offices. And they kind of just, it was weird. Like, they didn't really care that I was there. They just, like, kind of pointed me in a direction and told me to go over there. And some ladies that were, like, secretaries or something. And so I did. I followed kind of, you know, the little corridor that went into the building. And when I got to the end, there was a guy there, and he was just, he didn't really care that I was there. I mean, I tried to show him the dictionary and, you know, point out a few words and stuff, and he didn't seem to care. So he put me out on this balcony for a little while where they had actually put all the drugs, which was so odd. There was, like, cocaine everywhere with the broken pieces of art, like, all on the ground. And so he put me out on that balcony for, like, about 3 hours, and I was just like, okay, why am I out here? It was, like, the weirdest thing. So finally they brought me back in, and they decided to put me down in this cell. Well, they led me down this corridor, and it was very, like, kind of Beirut looking, like, very old and indoor, outdoor, and very damp, and very narrow corridors and stairs leading. It was like a maze, an indoor, outdoor maze. So when we get to the very end of it, there is a cell, and it is all made out of it's just a giant cell. And so he opened the door to the cell, and I looked to the right, and I saw like 7 men there, and they all looked like they were drunk or on drugs. They looked dirty. They looked like they had been in there without baths for a week. And then I kind of looked over to the left, and there was like a torture chair that, you know, they could hook you up to wires and stuff. And it was very dungeonous looking. And then when I looked up at the ceiling, there was no ceiling. It was just bars. And so I looked up and I looked all around, and the guard was pushing me to go in there with his machine gun. And so I put my arms like on the side of the bars of the doorway, and I looked and I was like, I'm not going in there. I'm like, you're out of your mind. I'm, you know, and I yelled something. I'm sure it wasn't a nice thing. I said, I'm not going in there. I'm like, you can kill me now. I'm not going in there. And so he starts pushing me in there with the machine gun. And the next thing I know, it was the weirdest thing. There was a motorcycle kind of on the side right here. And for some reason, I just jumped on top of the motorcycle, kind of side saddle, and just sat there with my arms crossed. And so this other guard comes over, and they start yelling at each other, kind of arguing over me, obviously. And I'm just ignoring them because I don't understand them anyways. And next thing I knew, they leave, and they just left me sitting there. So I sat there actually for 3 days. And during that 3-day period, they did bring some other women there. One in particular was a lady that had 3 young children, all under the ages of 5. Wow. And one, she was still breastfeeding, and they didn't know where to put her. So they brought this giant mattress and kind of laid her out on the mattress with their kids. And for the next 3 days, it was like surreal. These little kids were coming up to me, trying to touch my hair and offering me popcorn. And I was like looking around going, where am I? This is just weird. And it was raining half the time. And Quito, like I said, is up in the mountains. So the weather is really unpredictable there, and it's on the equator. So you could have all 4 seasons in one day. So, and I'm sitting there in a flowery long dress.
And sandals.
Yeah. So anyways, my embassy finally did come after 3 days. And after that, the embassy told the Interpol that, okay, what are they charging me with? Because they hadn't even charged me with anything up to this point. And she said, well, they wouldn't give them an answer. And they wanted me, actually, the Interpol wanted me to sign some papers. And I couldn't read it because it was all in Spanish. And so I told the, you know, embassy, I said, well, if you'll read these to me, I'll sign them. And they said, well, we're not lawyers. We can't read this to you or translate it. And I said, oh, really? I said, well, what are you here to do? And they said, well, we're just here to make sure that you're okay, and also to contact any family that you might have. And I said, oh, okay, well, then, yeah, if you can call my dad. So they did. But they did tell the Interpol that they had to either release me or charge me with something because, you know, I was being held illegally. And so later that day, the Interpol, I guess they, you know, they didn't want to deal with it. So they winded up transferring me to another place called CDP. And there, I was actually there for 30 days.
Wow.
Being held illegally also. And during that 30 days, I got really sick. I got pneumonia just from not having proper nutrition and being out in the cold in a summery dress. And it was just awful. My family actually, since the embassy had called my dad had come in contact with some missionaries that lived in Quito. And they were with, like, the Peace Corps. And turned out it was, like, a husband. He was a pastor, and the wife was a nurse. And so they came out to the jail and checked on me in person. And it was great that they came because, you know, she brought antibiotics, and they brought some food and some clean clothes and things like that. But they had put me – the jail actually had put me out in this cell. It looked like a big cage. And there was about 20, 25 women in this cage. And it was indoor, outdoor as well. And at night when the women slept, they would just put about 10 mattresses mm-hmm. all over the floor, and they were pancake mattresses, maybe like that thick. And they'd be all over the floor, and women would be sleeping just kind of over each other in a big cage. And most of the women that were in that cell were there for, like, fraud, writing bad checks, like, just minor mm-hmm. type of crimes. So they were actually very motherly towards me, and they were offering me something to drink and trying to get me to eat and trying to, you know, kind of wean me, like, get me better, mm-hmm. which was a blessing. And so I ended up being there for 30 days. And then again, my embassy and some human rights lawyers came, and they were trying to get me out on habeas corpus, but wasn't working. And so they told the jail, they said, look, you either have to charge her or you have to let her go. Mm-hmm. And again, they didn't want to deal with me. And so they winded up sending me to another prison called Camp Inca Penitentiary for Women. Mm. And once you're there, they have to charge you. Like, they can't keep you there illegally. So somebody, I don't know who, finally charged me with something. So Camp Inca became kind of my home prison. I did get transferred quite a few times after that as well to other prisons mm-hmm. around Ecuador, but Camp Inca became my home prison. Also, I want to let you know that Camp Inca also, even though it's a real prison, mm-hmm. I also am using it as a metaphor. Like, for what is your Camp Inca? What have you been through?
Yes.
Do you keep going back to it, or are you doing something and moving forward from it? Mm. You know, so it doesn't all go in vain, whatever you've been through. Mm-hmm. So I am using it kind of with that double meaning.
Well, and Julian, they are going to want to pick up a copy of your book, Surviving Camp Inca, A Life-Changing Prison Experience. If you're really listening to this, this is not fiction. This is real life here. The story that you're hearing, this woman lived it out. And we're only 30 plus days into her scenario. And I'm telling you right now, you have to pick up a copy, because we're not going to be able to go through every story. You will. I already told you, you'll be gagging. You'll be laughing. You'll be mad. You'll be wanting to say a prayer going, why in the you know what did something not happen? I don't care where you are in your life. And just as Julian mentioned, she mentioned your own Camp Inca. Maybe what's holding you back? What do you keep, you know, going back to, or it's your hang up, your hiccup, that speed bump in your life, that past maybe. It could be that relationship. And so as we continue to talk about that, keep in mind that maybe you too are imprisoning yourself. It's a self-imprisonment, and it's something that we can very easily do, unfortunately, with our life. But you're definitely going to want to pick up a copy of her book, Surviving Camp Inca. Now, of course, we will have all of the links in the show notes, because, yeah, there's so much. I have read this entire book. I'm just, Julian, I don't know. I mean, we're only 30 days into this. You are a beautiful, young, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, striking American who's now caught in Ecuador, who has not yet been charged. I mean, now eventually, I mean, we got to that part. They finally charged you after 30 plus days. I mean, what was going through your mind?
Oh my gosh. I was like, why am I here? I didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody up until this point was telling me I was going free. My embassy was saying they're not charging you. They have to let you go. Mm-hmm. The human rights people, you are not going to stay here. Lawyers were coming, because they're like, you don't call lawyers. They come to the prison. They try to kind of recruit you, I guess, mm-hmm. or be recruited. And so all of them were like, oh my gosh, your case is easy. We'll get you in and out of here. So I was being told, fed all these different lies. The DEA actually was coming to visit me too, to ask me tons of questions about everything that happened. And they were like, don't worry, you're going to go home. No problem. Meanwhile, back in the States, mm-hmm. my dad was gaining contact contact with like the State Department and, you know, local representatives in Tennessee to try to help me get out. And they were like, oh my gosh, she's going to go free. There's no problem. This is like an easy open shut case. So after that, it took me 2 years to even get to court.
Oh my gosh. And 2 years?
2 years. And for 2 years, I thought every single day I was going free. I thought that they were going to just show up miraculously with some freedom papers and say, here you go, go home. But that didn't happen. During that 2 years, I got transferred two more times to different prisons. Wow. Every time I got transferred to a prison, and the reason they transferred me after this was because they thought I wanted to escape. Now, who wouldn't want to escape? Okay.
I'm right there with you.
That was definitely on the list of things to do. In fact, my dad told me, he said, if you have an opportunity to go, go for it. He's like, we are behind you 100% because the system wasn't working for me. So it was obvious.
Well, they didn't have a system.
Exactly. They didn't have a system. And so finally they, So I guess they figured I was wanting to escape. So they transferred me the first time to Latacunga, which was about 2 hours away from Quito. And it was surrounded by volcanoes. And it was a very primitive prison. There was maybe 12 women in that prison. And then on the other side of a wall was about maybe 50 men that were on that side of the prison. And they didn't have very much food there. One day, this girl was cooking this big pot of soup out on this open fire. And she and I was thinking, what is that and everything? And she was like, caldo de... Anyways, it was horse hoof soup. Caballo. Sopa de caballo. And I'm like, what? And so when I'm looking it up on my dictionary, I was like, oh my God, I'm not going to eat a horse. I mean, really? And so, yeah, they didn't have the best food. So actually, when I was at that prison, the guards would take me out to the local markets and I would have to do my own grocery shopping, which wasn't so bad. And I usually had to, you know, buy them something too for their families because the guards there are very poor. So they don't really have even money to support their families. And so I'd have to pay them or buy them something, and then we'd go back, and we had our own little kitchenette so we could cook our own stuff if we had pots and pans and things like that.
Well, what did the prison provide?
Just really a room to sleep in. Some of the prisons, you had to pay for a room if you wanted like your own bed. You had to provide your own mattress and your own bed and your own space. But if you didn't have money, they would usually just put you in a room with like a tiny room too, with like maybe 4 to 6 other women and sometimes their children. A lot of people don't realize this, but in Ecuador, not only is the parent the mother is arrested, but the children have to go to prison with her because they don't have like family that can watch them. So the jails are overcrowded with lots of children as well. And they can live there up until they're 18.
Wow.
Yeah. So you can imagine the other problems that come up, especially with the prisoners having affairs with like the sons and things like that. There's a lot of abuse going on and it's really hard to watch. I mean, most of the time I spent my time in my room, whichever prison I was in, because I just didn't want to watch what was happening. I was checked out. So I didn't make a lot of friends. Nobody could really relate to what I was going through because most people there were like true drug traffickers. So it was definitely a different kind of experience for me than a lot of other people that were in prison there. But I did, after Latacunga, I finally, I did get transferred back to Camp Inca. It's funny, every time I get transferred somewhere, I get transferred back to Camp Inca. So that also goes along with my metaphor.
Yes.
So I got transferred back, and then I'd become good friends with a girl named Lucia, and she was an Ecuadorian girl, and she kind of became my best friend. I mean, I don't know. She wasn't innocent, but we just really hit it off. She spoke a little bit of English and stuff. And so she became friends with one of the directors of the jail system, and he became very infatuated with her. So he actually winded up sending both of us to a jail called Jail 4, which was a very small jail in Quito. And we were there not too long, but a couple of months until the government got overthrown. Then we got sent back to Quito. But we had a little bit more freedom, you know, to go out and do our shopping and do different things while we were at that prison. And then after I went back to Camp Inca is when I actually got – that was 2 years later – and I got my sentence. My sentence came down to 10 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I have to tell you about this, a little bit of this story is I was up in my room and the director called me down to his office. So I went down to his office and he said, I have some bad news for you. He said, your sentence has come down and here it is. He hands it to me, 10 years. So I start crying. I'm freaking out. I mean, just acting crazy. And so what does he do to console me? He sends the guard outside of the prison to go buy a big bottle of Jose Cuervo tequila and brings it back to me and hands it to me. And I downed it. I was just like, go, 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 go. I sat there and downed it. And against a wall, and I just laid there for like the rest of the day. I was just in shock. And I cried and screamed, and he just let me do my thing. He didn't even, he was like, oh my God. And see, up until this point, like I said, everybody thought I was going to go free, even the guards, even the director. I mean, they couldn't believe it. They felt sorry for me, you know, having a 10-year sentence. And
this was just 2 years into it, they finally sentenced you?
Actually, that was about almost 3 years at this point.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, because you get your, you go to court and then you get a sentence and then you have to get it confirmed and there's like all these steps. But meanwhile, and the reason it takes so long is because the government changes so rapidly, and every time they change anybody in the government, they have to change everybody. So they change president or they change anybody really in the government, they have to change the judges. And then once they change people, they have to start over in your case.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, we went through about five different lawyers while I was there.
Oh, not probably counting the ones that I remember reading in your book, which you're going to want to pick up a copy of Surviving Camp Inca, A Life-Changing Prison Experience. The links are in the show notes. I'm telling you, this is going to rock your world, and it's going to make you think about a lot of things. And we're going to talk about some of that here coming up. But all this change, I mean, you guys hired attorneys, given your list, and they just stole your money.
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, my dad was being called by people. They claimed to be CIA. Oh, we can extract your daughter tomorrow if, you know, you give us $100,000 today. And then he would get calls from lawyers that, you know, barely spoke English and turned out they didn't even handle drug cases. I mean, and, you know, and then, of course, I was being, you know, people are coming to the jail saying that they could get me out tomorrow if my dad would pay $5,000 or $200 or whatever amount. And so, you know, every time we had these opportunities, my dad was like, sure, let me just send it. Let me just send it, you know. And I mean, luckily my dad had, you know, okay money at the time. I mean, you know, I think I thought he had more money than he actually had. I mean, he wanted to get me out of there, and whatever the cost, you know.
Well, where was God in all of this?
Well, at this point, I was kind of at the point where it wasn't that I didn't still believe in God, but I wasn't even thinking it was God's problem. And I had missionaries that were visiting me from time to time, and they would say, Julianne, have you thought about reading your Bible, you know, and studying the word, and, you know, you may find answers this way. And I was like, you know what, I really just don't want to go there right now. I don't have time for it. I just, oxymoron, right? I don't have time for it. But, you know, I had bigger and better things I was trying to get out of there. So I didn't have time for God, basically. And so... And then this one missionary, Joan Ewing, she now she's known as my missionary mom, Joan, and I'm still in contact with her, and she's wonderful. She's like family, and she's to come see me on a regular basis, and she visited me at all these prisons. She always kind of, you know, came wherever I was for a while, and she was wonderful, and she never gave up on me, which I'm so grateful she didn't. But up until this point, I was still at Kambinka, and then I decided I was, after I got sentenced, I was going to escape, and for sure. And so we planned, me and a couple other girls, we planned this big escape, and anyways, make a long story short, I got sent to another prison and called Guayaquil. And Guayaquil actually was a big turning point for me. It was actually the worst prison in the world, rated at the time for women. Caracas, Venezuela, for men, was the worst prison for men at the time. And when I was in Guayaquil, my father actually contacted me, which being able to contact me in Guayaquil was really hard. Their whole phone system was really bad. And so he would write me letters and things like that, or contact me through the embassy. And so my dad said, well, I'm going to come out to Ecuador and see you. And I'm like, no, Dad, you don't want to come to Guayaquil. Guayaquil is not a place you want to visit, because out in the streets, it's like super dangerous. They'll like mug you for a dollar. I mean, it's just awful. So I actually had to find a bodyguard to be with him 24/7 while he came to visit me.
This is crazy. And you're doing this from prison.
Yes. And I was doing this from prison. There was a guy that used to come to the prisons, and he had permission to come in and out, and he would sell things to people. Or if you wanted him to go to the store and buy you food and bring it back, you could trust him. And so a lot of people used him, especially the foreigners. And so, yeah, I talked to him one day, and I was like, can you, like, be a bodyguard to my father? And he's like, oh, yeah, no problem. He goes, I'll stay with him at the hotel and bring him here in my car. And so he basically had a bodyguard, like, the whole entire time he was in Guayaquil, the whole week. So my dad came to visit me, and he brought me some things, and he's like, I need to talk to you about some things. I'm like, okay, Dad. So for one, he said, Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes is interested in coming to interview you. He's going to be interviewing a man on the men's side of the prison. He's like, so while he's here, do you want to be interviewed? And I said, well, not really. He said, well, come on. He's like, you know, you may be able to fight your case with this segment and maybe be able to go free. And I'm like, oh, well, then in that case, you know, so my answer was yes. And the second thing my dad wanted to talk to me about was God. He said, Julianne, are you reading your Bible? And I'm like, no. I'm like, are you okay? Because my dad had never talked about the Bible.
Right, because you had already tried when you were a wee little thing and went back there in 16 to try to talk to him.
Yes, and so I was in shock. And he said, well, your stepmom and I, we had to go to find some peace of our own. Because not only was I going through all this ordeal in this prison situation, they were in their own prison, you know, too. I mean, I didn't realize, I guess, it was all about me. So I didn't realize all the stuff they were going to. It was taking a toll on their marriage, on their businesses, on everything, you know, their whole life. And so they found a church close to them and decided they were going to find peace there. And they accepted the Lord. And their life started to go a different route, which is great. So my dad started talking to me and opening up about me, about everything, and he brought me a Bible. And so after my dad left, I did the 60 Minutes video, and it was so nice meeting Mike Wallace. He was such a nice man. He spent 2 days with me, and we filmed and talked, and he hated to leave me. He's like, I can't believe I have to leave you here, you know. And it was heart-wrenching. And unfortunately, they didn't show all the horrible, terrible conditions in the segment. And in fact, years later, my dad saw an interview with him. They were interviewing him, and they asked him if he had any regrets on any of the shows that he had done in the past. And actually, the segment I was in was one of them. He said, I wish that they would have showed more of what really went on in those prisons than what we showed. So that was a regret of his. But anyways, so after that segment and everything happened, there was a man that was on the men's side of the Guayaquil prison, and he was a big drug lord. And one of the girls, one of the other Americans that was in the prison with me, her, she used to go over to the men's side to see her husband, like on the weekends. They had conjugal visits for the weekends. And
this was allowed?
Yeah. Yeah. They had to have permission and everything, but they could go over there with a guard. And so they would stay the weekend. And so she came back one day and she said, there's a guy over on the men's side, and he really wants to talk to you. He's a drug lord and he's a nice guy. He's like, he'll probably give you like a turkey dinner or something just for coming over and seeing him. And I'm like, really? Okay, well, I'll go for the turkey dinner.
I'll go for the turkey.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Exactly. And so I did. He actually, the guy had scanners and computers and everything in his cell, because on the men's side, super corrupt, so they could have, they could pay the guards to bring them in all this, this equipment. So the guy made me some scan, some permission slips and stuff to go over to see him. So I went over to see him, and sure enough, he had the turkey dinner laid out and everything, and we had dinner and talked and everything. Told him my whole story, and he said, did you ever wonder what would have happened to you if you wouldn't have been arrested? And I'm like, well, I would have gone back to California, and I would, and the artwork would have gone on to New York, and I would have never known the difference. And he was like, that's not what would have happened to you. He goes, first of all, he's like, a couple of guys probably would have met you in Miami and taken you and the artwork to an undisclosed location, and they would have held a gun to your head, and they would have, they would have tested the drugs and waited out, made sure it was the shipment that they had ordered, and they would have held a gun to your head, and they would have given you one of two options. Either you do this for us again and become our human slave, basically, or they would have just killed me. And to be honest, I always say I found peace from a drug lord in that moment, because I was like, oh my gosh, things could be worse. And I actually felt grateful for everything I had been through up into that point. And, you know, I had started reading my Bible, too. So I started to feel, my heart started to melt a little bit, you know, at a time. And so I started to feel forgiveness, things that I hadn't felt in, you know, over 3 years. I started to feel forgiveness and love and you know, gratitude, and, you know, and after our meeting, I wept, of course, and talked to him. I said, how do you know all this? And he said, well, he said, I do, unfortunately, I do this to women all the time, even from myself. And I'm like, oh my gosh, really? He goes, yeah. He's like, I have a 25-year sentence. And, you know, he said, but I'm still in business. And he said, but the thing that confused him was I wasn't really the type of girl that normally they targeted. You know, they went more for the girl that was kind of down and out, didn't have a job or much of a family, and usually, you know, use drugs and stuff like that. And so that part of it, he couldn't really understand why they used me, but maybe just so they wouldn't think I was, had drugs on me, you know,
right?
Or with a bigger shipment going through, or anyways, there were a lot of different theories that were thrown around at the time. But I was so grateful to have met him, and that really gave me peace, because up until that point, I was kind of like, okay, what am I going to do if I ever see these people again, you know? And I mean, I don't want to go to jail for murder, you know, or something like that afterwards, you know?
Yes.
And there, and, you know, I was like, you know, what I can do is temporary. What God can do is eternal. And that really gave me peace. And so, yeah, like a flower, it's just, you know, petals started coming off. And I just, like, really started to feel more, like, not focused so much on my situation, more on God. And around this time, I started studying the Bible. My missionary mom came to visit me, and after she left, I remember it was Mother's Day weekend, and the jail went crazy that weekend. It was like all of a sudden, it was like God was there, but then the enemy started attacking. Ooh. There were parties everywhere. There was hardly any guards. Mm-hmm. That weekend, the girl that used to do my laundry at the time, she got murdered on the men's side of the jail. Just a lot of crazy stuff started happening. It was like the enemy was attacking. And I said, I got to get back to Camp Inca. Mm-hmm. I got to go back to my Camp Inca. And so I called the embassy, and they told me what I needed to do to get back there. And mm-hmm. it was a whole God thing, because everyone had told me, once you're in Guayaquil, you'll never get back to your original prison until you go free. It's like, it's unheard of. You just don't get sent back. And so anyways, I did everything I could, and I got sent back within a month. Mm. And once I got back to Camp Inca, my missionary mom started coming to visit me again. She had kind of been back and forth to the States on furlough and back and forth. So she came back to visit me, and she had been praying about it and stuff, about actually continuing the jail ministry, because nobody really studying the Bible. Like, she'd come and bring things, and they wanted the stuff, but they never wanted to study or get to know God. And so she kind of felt like a failure as far as that was concerned. Mm-hmm. And she said, so she came to visit me one day, and she said, well, I've been praying about it, and I really feel like the Lord is telling me that I'm not to come see you anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah. She's like, I'm not going to come and study with the girls anymore. I'm not going to talk with anybody anymore. She's like, I'm not going to study with anybody anymore. And I said, wait, oh no, I wanted to know if you wanted to do Bible study. She said, what? And I said, yeah. I said, well, when I was in Guayaquil, you know, I started reading my Bible and stuff, and I feel like I need to learn more about the Bible now. So if you can keep coming and teach me these things, it'd be great. So she said, okay, let me go home and pray about this, you know. So she came back like a couple days later. She said, okay, that's a deal. I'll come on Wednesdays, and we'll help the Bible study, and, you know, me, you, and another missionary. I said, okay, that'll be great. Mm-hmm. So for the next 6 months, I was doing Bible study every Wednesday, and it was wonderful. And the other women in the prison, they started to notice a big change in me. Just way I was acting and the way I felt, and I looked happier. And so a couple of them that spoke English, like, came and approached me, and they said, what are you guys doing on Wednesday? We want some of that. And I'm like, oh, I'm doing a Bible study with missionaries. I'm like, no, but you can't come, you know. So, well, why not? And I said, because she's my visit, and it's my time, and no. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, okay. And so I went to Joan, and I told her, and she goes, so why didn't you invite him to the Bible study? And I said, well, because it's my thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in prison, you don't have anything that's yours, really. Right. And that was the only thing I had of my own. Yeah. And so I didn't want to share it. And so Joan made it very clear that being a Christian, you have to share. Yes. Yeah. Kind of part of it. And I was like,
darn.
I'm like, no, I don't want to. So it took a while for my heart to soften over that. But and a few months later, it was around Christmas, and Joan had said, well, you know what? It's Christmas. She's like, I'm going to talk to the director and see if I could do like a Christmas party and have some other missionaries come in, and we'll do like a Christmas dinner for you guys and stuff with music and everything. And I said, okay, that'll be great. So we did that, and all the women that spoke English came to that. It was probably about 12 women. Wow. And we had a wonderful time, and at the end, they were like, can we come to your Bible study? And Joan's like, yes, you can. I'm like, okay. So actually, that ministry took off after that, and I had about a year and a half left in prison up until that point. And So we started doing Bible study with the group and everything every week. And, you know, we really started to grow as a body, you know, just the girls in there, that the foreign girls that spoke English, and become better friends. I mean, all those years there that I had been there already, I hadn't really developed too close of relationships. You know, I always was kind of set apart from all that. But at that point, we all started to kind of bond a little bit more. And then more blessings came out of it. My last year that I was there, actually, I was offered a bakery, so that was nice. I figure, well, I need to do something my last year here, so the time will pass a little bit faster. And yeah,
did you ever think, Julianne, that you would own a business in prison?
No.
I'm just putting it out there like that, because that's just, to me, a little strange.
Yeah. Well, these prisons are almost like little villages. And so people actually have their own businesses. Sometimes they're in their rooms. Sometimes the prison will let you use, like, if there's an area that's not being used, you can set up a little kiosk or something outside to serve food or to, you know, sell things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times some of these prisoners, you know, their families will bring them things to sell. This one girl was selling like oils, like like lavender oil and different kinds of oils, and another lady had food, and another lady selling Coca-Colas and stuff like that. So yeah, at one point it was funny because also past the time earlier on in my story, I started doing reflexology and massage therapy just to pass the time. And it's funny because now I'm a reflexologist, and so I pretty much, you know, self-taught myself while I was in prison. And I had a lot of people visiting me from the South American Explorers Club also from time to time, and I always had these really a lot of holistic type of visitors coming to see me, and they would bring me books and oils and all kinds of different things. And so I was very interested in like the holistic healing aspect that, and always reading up on it. I mean, I had plenty of time, so I was reading anatomy and physiology and all these different books just to, you know, pass the time. And it was very interesting. I found later on that, you know, if there would have been someone behind me pushing me like into college, I may have become a nurse, or I may have become a chiropractor, or something else, you know, in life. So, yeah, I found a lot of different interests that I would have never even known I had if I would have stayed in Hollywood.
Yes. And you didn't. Well, maybe you wish you had stayed. But you know what? You learned a lot of lessons on the way. The bakery obviously grew you in your resources, stretched you even more, your reflexology, your massage that you did. What were some of the other things, looking back now, having kind of a God perspective of what happened there? What do you see are little things that he dropped, little nuggets that he left for you?
Well, I think one of the nuggets that I got was that everybody has gone through stuff. You know, it doesn't matter if it's everybody's been through hard stuff. And whether it's hard or not hard, or it's all a matter of perspective, you know, of what you're going through. Because you look back on it and you're like, wow, at the time it seems like it was awful and terrible and a curse. And then looking back at it all, I think, oh my gosh, I look at the blessings.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I had a lot of, after I went free, I couldn't trust people. And now I have discernment. So it's almost like God changed the trust, non-trust, to discernment. So, you know, it's all a matter of perspective and where you are in life. And, you know, you want to try and turn the negative into a positive, no matter what you've gone through. And I know that sounds almost impossible, probably, to a lot of people, because I know there's a lot of situations out there that are awful and terrible. And you think, how could I ever turn that negative into a positive? But with time and healing and God, you can. You can turn everything, anything, into a positive. And if you don't believe me, you can look in the Bible and there are tons of stories that God does exactly that.
Yes. Well, you can't leave us hanging. I mean, we're not going to tell all the stories because you all who are listening are going to pick up your own copy of Surviving Camp Inca, A Life-Changing Prison Experience. Julianne, you were sentenced to 10 years. You had the Christmas dinner, the bakery, all of that. When did this story at Camp Inca end for you?
Well, while I was there, they passed a law called the 2-for-1, and that law says you can go free with half your time. Mm. And so I got to go free with 5 years instead of 10. Yeah, so that was another God thing. My last year there, I actually opened the Bible one day. I was having a really bad day, and I opened my Bible, and I was like, God, when am I going free? And I found a verse, and it said, children, I promise you this, you will not spend one day less or one day more, for I will set you free. And I said, great, I'm going to be here one more year, and close my Bible. And anyways, the miracle in all of this is I actually flew into the country on July 5th, mm-hmm. and I flew out of the July 5th, 1995, mm-hmm. and flew out of the country July 5th, 2000. So God kept his promise. Mm. I did not spend one day less or one day more. He set me free. And I really believe that my prison started when I flew into the country, mm. and it ended when I flew out of the country. And the way this all happened, really, is that I started my last couple of months in jail, I started reading law books in Spanish, and I found a loophole in one of the law books that one of my roommates that I had over the years had told me about. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading up on it and trying to figure it out and everything. And yeah, I could get out 3 weeks earlier than my release date. Wow. And then get out and spend a couple days or a couple weeks in keto and then regulate all my paperwork and then be able to fly out, you know, on a certain date. And so it all really worked out. It was a God thing completely because, I mean, the chances of me flying in and out on the same exact day 5 years later is a miracle in itself because people do not get out of prison when they're supposed to in Ecuador. It's just unheard of. Mm. It's usually like a 4 or 5 month delay. Mm. And so that was a big miracle.
Well, you're a miracle. I mean, I am blown away. I'm speechless. There were times that when I was reading your book and I would read it amongst, I mean, I have 5 children, so my life is kind of a tug of war sometimes as to what I can and cannot do with my time. And so I'd be in something, they're like, Mom, I need you. I'm like, no, wait, I gotta know what happens here. I mean, you go through, and we're not going to go through all of it, but you had the Kill the Rats campaign. Oh my gosh. I mean, you got to pick up, you want this book just for the Kill the Rats campaign. I'm telling you, it's the best thing ever. I thought it was really ingenious, actually, but we're not going to tell them the story because they got to pick up their own copy. But
all of the crazy memories, to be honest, when I went free, oh my gosh, what a day. It was like incredible. But, you know, looking back at all the negative that I got in all the prisons, I had to leave the country on a good note. I didn't want to go back to the States thinking I hate Ecuador. Yeah. So the 3 weeks that I stayed in Ecuador, mm-hmm. I went up to a volcano and I went to some hot springs and got to see the beauty of the country. Oh. And, you know, and I got to meet with Joan Ewan and her friends and her pastors and different people that were missionaries that had come to help me during that 5 years. Yeah. I got to, you know, go to people's houses and thank them personally, you know, for coming to visit me and for all the wonderful gifts they had given me mm-hmm. while I was there. So that was another blessing. And I was really happy that I did get to leave on that happy note. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I got back to the States, oh, my gosh. I was like, am I ever going to leave this country again? I'm not sure.
Maybe not real soon.
No, actually, it's funny because my husband and I just celebrated my big 5-0, and my husband took me to the Dominican Republic, and that's the first time I've been out of the country since.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. Well, God has healed you because for you, I mean, seriously, Julianne, you just have this heart, and you talk about this as if it truly is fiction. But this was your life. You lived this out. And I mean, when you talk about that, you have a few pictures in your book, and which I know are very limited because they didn't allow you to take pictures and what you could and couldn't do, and things could be confiscated and all that jazz. But our prison system here is like living like a king and queen when it comes to their system there and what you went through.
Yeah, I mean, there are some freedoms there that we wouldn't have here, of course. Like, you could never get a guard to take you to the grocery store or, you know, or anywhere for that matter.
Yes.
But at the same time, yeah, it's like, it's just a whole different way of life. It's a whole different culture of life, put it that way. Plus, I had to learn a whole new language.
Yeah.
And, of course, there were people from all over the world in these prisons, so I was learning multiple languages. In multiple prisons, and sometimes Quechuan, which is an Indian language, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, I don't remember too much of it anymore. But you know, it was just like a big culture shock. And I mean, the prisons are so different in other countries. I mean, I can't even imagine. I mean, I look back and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, was that really me? I mean, because I've come so far in life. I mean, I really live a blessed life now. My husband, he's just wonderful. He spoils me, you know, and I have a beautiful house and nice friends. And so it really does seem surreal. I always say I had three lives. I had the life before Ecuador, the life during Ecuador, and now my life after Ecuador. And they're just all three so different. So yeah, looking back at it, it doesn't even feel like it was me. Such a different person too. I mean, as you can tell, I don't even have blonde hair anymore.
Well, you know, with age, we like to change our color, right? That's great. Well, what does freedom mean to you?
Well, freedom is really being able to do whatever you want to do when you want to do it. And of course, the ultimate freedom is in Jesus. You know, some people think that Jesus hinders people and takes away and with all the rules and regulations and everything. But, you know, all those rules and regulations are there to keep us safe. And, you know, I thank him every day for it. And I'm glad I have the I can choose, you know, to be free in Jesus and to have the freedoms to talk about him and to tell other people about him and just to live life for him and enjoy the world like he wants us to enjoy it. I mean, there's so much to see in life, so many people to meet and so many things that we have to do, you know? And so, yeah, freedom for me is, you know, I love doing reflexology. That's one of my babies now. I love it. I have, you know, my regular clients that I see on a weekly basis, and I'm just so grateful that I'm able to do that, and I'm able to make my own schedule, and you know, I don't have to punch a time clock, you know,
which is nice.
Yeah, it's really, I know everybody can't do that, but you know, you can though, if you want to. I mean, you know, it's just a matter of how bad you really want your freedom in all the different aspects. I mean, freedom's not just about one aspect. I think it's about everything, emotional, you know, financial, everything, health, you know, there's so many different, ways you can be free and enjoy life. But I think, you know, God wants us to enjoy life, and he wants us to live for him and to just to love the world.
Yeah. And sometimes that's kind of tough to do. And especially one who has been in prison, what would you tell the person who's listening right now, who's just maybe at their wit's end, or they're just struggling, like, gosh, I feel like I'm not in prison, but I feel like I am. Maybe they're in a horrible relationship. They're husband and wife, but they don't even connect. They don't have a connection, you know, with their children. What would you tell that person who's stuck in Camp Inca?
Well, I would tell you, first of all, to seek in the Lord, trust in the Lord. Mm-hmm. Read your Bible. If you don't have a Bible, talk to somebody that has talked to you about the Bible, mm-hmm. and they will bring you one. If you don't even know what Bible to buy, because there are so many out there.
Yes.
I usually read the New Living Translation, which mm-hmm. is pretty easy to understand. Mm-hmm. But I would, for one, seek in the Lord and pray. Learn how to pray. It can be a simple conversation between you and God. Mm-hmm. Hi, God. How are you doing today? I mean, everybody speaks to God in their own way. It doesn't have to be in this ritualistic, like, way that you think it has to be. It's very simple. Mm-hmm. But that's the first thing I would do. And I would definitely seek counsel. After I went free, I actually did a discipleship class with my dad's pastor. It was mm-hmm. at a Presbyterian church, but I was not Presbyterian, but he opened up to me. He was a recovering drug addict, and he had been in prison, so he knew kind of a little bit of what I had gone through. Mm-hmm. We did not meet in the church. We actually met out on the lake on a dock, overlooking the beautiful water every single day, 5 days a week, mm-hmm. and met for about 2-3 hours and just talked about life and the different things that, you know, I wanted. And he really helped me to forgive and move forward. Mm-hmm. Within 6 months, I got a job. You know, set your goals. Set mm-hmm. your goals of what you want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do right out of prison, you know, but my stepmom gave me a wonderful opportunity. She said, Julianne, she's like, do you want to go back to school? What would you like to study? And I thought, oh gosh, am I ready for school? You know, and I thought, well, maybe I want to go do nails, work in a spa. Mm-hmm. She said, okay, well, let's check out the local beauty school. And so we did that. And 9 months later, I had my my nail license. Wow. So after that, it's like I've worked in the spa business ever since. I love it. I worked at a world-class spa in Atlanta called Chateau Alon, and learned lots of different spa techniques there, massages, body treatments, facials, all kinds of things, reflexology. Mm-hmm. And then I got certified in reflexology. And so, you know, reinvent yourself. Mm. I mean, that's a great way to move forward. Think, you know what? You're tired of your old self. Reinvent yourself. You're allowed to do that. People, it's almost like they have to be given permission. Yeah. Well, give yourself permission. You don't have to wait for someone else to give you permission to reinvent yourself. And with God's help, and if that's His will for you, oh my gosh, He will not put those ideas in your head and take them away from you.
Amen.
But you do have to respond to them, and you do have to, you know, be proactive. It's not going to just be handed to you on a silver platter. But, you know,
no, because they might be serving rats on that silver platter.
That's true. Yeah,
stay away from rats.
I haven't seen a rat since, by the way.
Oh, thank goodness, because you got to pick up your book, because if nothing else, it's about the rats. Now, I know we make light of it, but seriously, I mean, we do this, and you're so right. I mean, you've got to respond. I think we are waiting to be struck by lightning, and here, 5 years grooming you in prison, God did. You know, yep. And if you were to look back, you know, because the drug lord, like you said, asked that really, you know, really that thought-provoking question that mm-hmm. was that light bulb for you and said, what do you think would have happened if you would have made it to the States? Well, what do you think would happen with your life, Julianne, if you never went to Ecuador? You know, you wonder what the person you would have become or the other prisons you may have ended up in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because, I mean, I had a few boyfriends in California before that wanted to marry me. And I look back and I think, oh, my gosh, we would have probably been in divorce. I mean, if I would have married any of those guys, would have probably not been married still. Mm-hmm. I might have had, you know, multiple kids or, you know, been a single mom, which is fine. But, you know, that it's hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, I look at what my mom went through when I was a child,
yes,
you know, raising me just as a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I knew in my heart that I didn't want that for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, I never thought I'd get married. I mean, if it wouldn't have been for Ecuador, actually, I probably would have never gotten married, because up until that point, my dad used to always say to me, if you don't get married, you will never get divorced. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, huh, that makes sense.
I'll go with that one.
I'll go with that one. And it's funny, until I was in Ecuador, my last couple years in Ecuador, when I started reading the Bible and stuff, that's when I was thinking, well, maybe I'll get married. Maybe I'll have a child, you know, mm-hmm. up until that point, I had never even considered it, really. And then, you know, I have no children of my own, but I have a wonderful husband, and oh my gosh, it's like, thank God I didn't miss out on that blessing.
Yeah, he's a keeper.
He is.
He's a keeper. Well, I've got to ask you this question, because people I know are going to want to get in touch with you, if nothing else, for the rat.
Rats.
Don't contact her regarding the rats. I'm just saying. No. For those who want to talk to you further than not about the rats, where can
I wish I had pictures of the rats, because in one prison, they were this big. They were so big. They were like over a foot.
They're like a cat.
Yes, they were the size of a cat. Ugh. And they used to come out at night and screech and claw at each other and fight. And this is when I was in this cage with 20 other women, and I was like, okay, they should be in a cage. I should be free. It's like, oh, talk about playing with your head. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's just, you've got to pick up a copy of her book. So, Julian, where can they find you?
Well, you can go to www.campinca.com. That's CAMPINCA.com. Or you can go to my Facebook page, and that would be Surviving Camp Inca on Facebook. I do a little bit of Twitter. You can look at that up at Survive Camp Inca. So those are probably the three places. Also, my book is for sale on Amazon, and it's under Surviving Camp Inca. It's also in the Kindle version, and hopefully one day we'll do an audio version, so we'll see. We're praying about that one.
That would be awesome. I don't know, though. I don't know that I want – who would you talk about? Who would you get to talk about those rats? Can you tell I'm hung up about the rats? Oh, and there's a lot more in there, so that's why you have to get your copy. I know. Julian, you have been just a true gem. I am just so blessed to, number one, have met you, to call you friend, sister in Christ. Thank you so much for spending your time with us and sharing your heart and what God has gifted you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Well, now, before we let you go, though, besides the rats, we'll let the rats go in their little corners for now. But is there anything that we have left out that you think that, oh, my gosh, they just have to know this part?
Oh, gosh. There's just so many parts to this story. To be honest, you have to read the book.
Oh, you do. I totally agree. I mean, we would be here. I don't know how you would do the audio version. I mean, oh, my goodness gracious. It's amazing.
And certain friends of mine have also talked about, you know, almost everyone that reads the book is like, when is this going to become a movie? And I'm like, well, if you want to make a movie out of it, go for it. You know, I was offered some deals on Lifetime movies, mm-hmm. and Locked Up Abroad and some other shows here and there. But they pay you so little money to do it. And then, they want to own the rights to your stuff. And so I never did go that route. Mm-hmm. But if somebody does want to make my movie, feel free. Obviously, you'd have to contact me, but right. Obviously, you know, I'm not a movie maker, but yeah, so we'll see where that goes.
Well, God, I know, has big plans for you. He obviously positioned you exactly where he believed you needed to be. And I believe he removed you from your prison to show mm-hmm. you a taste of heaven here on earth.
Yes.
And what a blessing that is. I got to ask you, is there any quote or favorite Bible verse that you want to leave with us?
Oh, wow. There's so many. I do like Proverbs 3:5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. That's one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. And another one of my favorites actually is Matthew 17:20. You don't have enough faith, Jesus told them. I tell you the truth. If you had faith, even as small as a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it would be moved. Nothing would be impossible. And no matter what your Camp Inca is that you're going through, just know that if you trust in the Lord and you pray about it, it will be moved, whatever mountain it is. And it will not be impossible. God wants to see you succeed.
Amen. He does.
So all you have to do is ask, and he will open that door.
Mm-hmm. That's gorgeous. Julianne, as we close, I want to ask you one last question. Mm-hmm. This is the series. It's called My Strength is My Story. What has your story gifted you?
Wow. Well, I think my story has gifted me just feeling grateful for everything I've gone through. Mm-hmm. And people thank me all the time for writing the book, and so they can see the blessings in their lives. And I try to talk to people about sharing their own story. Mm. So if anything, if I can encourage other people to share their stories and to make a difference in other people's lives, then I guess I've done my job.
You've done it very well.
Aw.
Very well. And you all know that the links are in the show notes. Surviving Camp Inca, a life-changing prison experience. Julianne, it is truly my privilege and my pleasure to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great getting to know you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Feeling inspired, ready to train for life, and love your journey? Visit createyournow.com for more incredible resources to help you along the way. We'll see you next time on Create Your Now, Your Best Selfie. And remember, always be sure you consult your physician before beginning any health and fitness plan.